power of the network is real, and it's the responsibility of all of those of us who have kind of made it to where we want to be to open up ourselves to those people who are looking for help. And if somebody calls you and asks for help, you gotta say yes.
This is the ETF Experience Podcast, brought to you by Exponential ETFs. We'll take you behind the scenes of the asset management industry and talk to the innovators who are changing the way investors trade, invest, and build better portfolios. Here's your host, Phil Bock.
All right. Welcome back to the ETF Experience Podcast. We're back in Detroit. It's been a while since we've been in Detroit for the podcast. Feels great to be back in our home studio, finally get another home game. And we've got a great show today. My guest this week is Andy Stewart. He's the Chief Investment Strategist at Exchange Capital Management in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Andy is a CFA, he's a CAIA, and a great all-around guy and a friend. Andy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
And we also have a special guest. We have co-host Charles Regaus.
Thank you, Phil, for having me. Appreciate it. Andy, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Okay, so Andy, I thought we'd start off with Exchange Capital Management. If you can give us an overview of what you do, and then we'll start talking about how you specifically invest. And there's some very interesting things that you do that we've talked about, and especially a blog post that you've written on passive investing being kind of a false debate, or the active versus passive. The whole thing is kind of a mislabeled debate. And I want to get into that. I want to get into currency hedging. But let's start off with an overview of Exchange Capital Management.
Sure. We're a traditional registered investment advisor, wealth management firm, been around for about 30 years, downtown Ann Arbor, right next to the farmers market. We're a fiduciary, again, registered investment advisor, focusing on financial planning and wealth management. So when it comes to people achieving their goals in their lives and managing their wealth, the kind of biggest lever is spend less than you make, and kind of down from there is, do you have a financial plan where you're kind of matching your assets to your liabilities, and then figure out what your asset allocation is going to be. And we have a whole team of folks who are on the advisory and financial planning teams that do that work really well and advise our clients. Then you get to what my team works on, which is the actual investment of the wealth that our clients have amassed over the years into the capital markets. And that's where our team spends our time buying stocks, bonds, ETFs, keeping them allocated to the right risk market that meets their financial plan.
Obviously, on this show, we talk a lot about ETFs, and our focus is on ETFs. But you mix in ETFs, you do use ETFs, but also you use individual stocks, and you have your own investment thesis that you deliver to your clients, not necessarily through other funds, but you do a lot of direct investing into stocks. What is the point? What is the catalyst for you to use an ETF versus just implementing the strategy directly yourself?
Sure. When it comes to keeping your assets as an individual, keeping your assets allocated into risk markets, staying emotionally involved is really important. Folks who don't understand what their portfolio is doing for them and how it's invested often leads to them making poor decisions that are triggered by emotions and fear when the market starts to go sideways. So make sure that your clients understand what they're invested in. And the history of our firm has been mostly in individual securities, and most of the people who come hire us, that's what they already know. And you could have a conversation with them about large cap value versus mid cap growth. But in the grand scheme of things, again, it's, are you allocated to equities? And the particular tilts around that matter less than that overall asset class. Those tilts certainly matter, but they matter less. And what matters the most is that the client understands what they're invested in, and they're going to stay invested even when you get into a more difficult market. So we just have a lot of clients who want to see companies that they understand and know inside their portfolios, and we're willing to take on that responsibility and do that lift of making that decision to choose which stocks we're going to buy and which ones we aren't going to own in portfolios.
Andy, you had mentioned that you, and maybe I misheard, that you want the clients to be emotionally in touch or invested. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And I usually hear the opposite, because when you act on emotion, obviously you tend to trade at the wrong time, et cetera. And that's actually one of the good reasons why you would want to hire a money manager, because it kind of removes your own personal emotion from it.
Yeah, if you can, you want to remove the negative, fearful emotions in those times of crisis. This is conversations I have with my daughter, talk about bucket filling. If you're interacting with other human beings and you kind of build up a reservoir of trust in a process over a long period of time, then when you find yourself in a time of crisis, you're more likely to stick with it. So it might feel a little bit counterintuitive. And certainly, if you could just have everybody trade like robots, we'd all be great. But we aren't robots, we're human beings. So therefore, you kind of take it the other way and say, let's engage people in what's happening inside their portfolios. Make sure they understand what's happening in their portfolios. Even in a year like this, where we've climbed the wall of worry to a really significant degree, we still want to be engaging with people who actually own these assets. It's their accounts. It's not our money. It's their money. We want to make sure that they understand what they're invested in so that if we do go into, you know, if this year ends up flipping over the way that fourth quarter did last year, they can still stay invested and not panic and run for the hills.
Now, when you look at individual stocks, do you do a top-down tilt? Are you looking for certain factor tilts and to implement them yourself with the stocks that you pick? Or is it a bottom-up valuation model, securities valuation model that you put on the individual stocks?
Sure. It's a little bit of both. We do pay attention to sector allocations and pay attention to what the overall market is. The tech sector, for example, right now is about 20% of the overall market. We pay attention to that number. We're not going to ramp our model up to 50% tech or all the way down to 5% tech, just to use that one large sector as an example. So there is a little bit of a top-down pay attention to the overall market, because keep in mind, we do have clients who don't want individual securities. They are self-aware enough that they know that individual securities will go up or down by 20 or 30% if you have a bad earnings call, and waking up that morning and seeing a single name in their portfolio down significantly overnight is just too much of a rattle for them, and they prefer a fund. And we are happy to use ETFs, sector ETFs, and kind of those broad-based products that will get them to more or less the same place as the individual security model, obviously with some differences, but more or less the same place, with a ride that's a little bit smoother when you look at the individual building blocks. So we do want those two different methods to be fairly similar and have the same kinds of tilts to things like tech and healthcare and small cap and the right amount to international, so on and so forth. But we do want them to be somewhat similar, and therefore there's this top-down approach. Meanwhile, okay, you say you want to allocate 20% to technology or 15% to healthcare. What are the building blocks, the individual stocks inside of there? That's where there is kind of more of a bottoms-up approach. We look for companies that's very kind of Warren Buffett-esque, high barriers to entry, I'll steal his word, kind of moaty companies that are expected to do by and large better than their peers in whatever market they're engaged in over long periods of time. In the world of tech right now, this has been quite a while now, a few years, focusing on companies that have subscription-based revenues. We think that's very repeatable. We think it makes it easier for those businesses to plan. Microsoft and Office 365 is kind of the biggest example of that, but you also see lots of other smaller companies that, and large companies that are doing that kind of model. I mean, here we are in a WeWork office, and WeWork certainly has its own kind of troubles in the capital markets, but that underlying thesis of provide businesses with a subscription access to something that used to be capital intensive, that has a merit to it in the world of technology.
Yeah, and that business model has seen explosive growth, and I get concerned sometimes when you look at the valuations of some of the tech companies and some of the companies that are in that space. So you really have to balance. You're looking for companies that have that moat, that have the durable competitive advantage, that are in the right sector that you're bullish on, but then also don't have those runaway valuations. And using the two together, the ETFs with the individual stocks, I assume gives you some of that balance.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are spaces where individual stocks would be just too difficult or inefficient to get into. Most of our individual stock portfolio is large cap, some mid cap. We do have kind of an underrepresentation in the mega cap space. The top 10 of the S&P, we own a handful of them, but there are a number that we don't own. And even just having a 2% allocation to a $20 billion company, that's a significant anti-mega cap tilt versus the S&P 500 index.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the runaway of those in the S&P 500, you take the top five companies now comprise 15% of the total index. The top 50 are more than half. The top 50. So it's the S&P 500, but there's as much weight. There's less weight in the bottom 450 companies than the top 50 combined. So there's a tremendous amount of concentration. And there's always been concentration in any market cap weighted index, but the more that market cap weighted factor or that trend growth factor, the more that it runs and the more the valuations separate on those top names, the bigger that concentration risk gets. And I think there's a lot of people in the market who've been lulled into a false sense of complacency, especially when they look at passive investing or quote unquote passive investing. And the idea is that, well, if you're in a market cap weighted fund, if you're in an index fund, you're not really making any bet. That's neutral. And I don't believe that to be the case. I think you are making a bet no matter what your strategy is. You're making a bet. And I know that you've written about that as well. So your most recent blog post is low cost investing is a thing, passive investing is not. What do you mean by that?
The idea is that somebody, some human somewhere, has made the decision about what's inside of a portfolio. Whether it's an individual portfolio like we manage that's mostly stocks, or a mutual fund, whether that's quote-unquote active or index mutual fund, or an ETF, a sovereign wealth fund, whatever. Some human decided what goes inside there. And folks, the easy one to point to is the S&P 500. It's a very well-known index. But even that, they say, is supposed to represent the 500 largest companies in the U.S. There's at least one that I can think of that's definitely in the top 500 that's not in there, and that's Tesla. And then there are two or three others, I believe, kind of lower down. Do they represent the vast majority of the 500 largest companies in the U.S.? Absolutely. Are they every single one? No. And there's some human who either is making that decision or wrote the set of rules that made that decision. And they are effectively being the active manager in that space, even if it's rules-based active management. And then you get into the weighting thing, which I know you guys talk about a lot. Is market cap weighting truly passive? I would argue no. I would say it's efficient, especially back in the day when trading costs were higher than they are now. It was super efficient. You could buy a set of stocks and then never touch it and know that they're going to go up and down and the market cap weighting will stay what it is. All you have to do is reinvest the dividends one way or another. But it's still a decision to kind of accept the market's weighting. And I actually look at healthcare stocks as a really good example. Drug companies, the way you're going to make money by investing in large drug companies over time is by them putting capital into R&D to do drug discovery and help cure diseases. We talk a lot about low hubris, high humility. I have no idea whether Johnson & Johnson or Amgen or Biogen is going to develop the next cure for cancer that's going to be really great for all of us and our parents and our grandparents and make those companies a ton of money. Who knows which one of them is going to make the next big hit? But if you just own the healthcare sector passively, you're going to own a ton of Johnson & Johnson versus all the rest. You're going to have this market cap weighted thing. When in reality, I would much rather kind of own more or less the same of a nice big basket of large drug companies, as long as they are all consistently allocating capital to their R&D pipe and working towards that hard work of real core science, which often fails, but sometimes you get nice big hits. If you just own that passively, then you're kind of saying, well, no, Johnson & Johnson is twice as likely to be good at that than other folks simply because they're a much larger company. And that logic doesn't make sense.
The weighting represents your conviction. And as you said, with healthcare, if you don't have strong conviction in any of those particular companies, you know that they're all good companies. Right. They're going to generate recurring revenue, but you don't know which one's going to make the next big one. Why would you do something like a market cap weighting, which is essentially saying the biggest one is going to succeed, which is not always true.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if you have a time machine, you don't diversify at all. You just look at who launched the best drug last month. Okay, it's BIB, and you put all of your 100% of your portfolio in that. And you let it pop overnight, and then you sell and move into the next thing. But without a real crystal ball or a time machine, diversification is the way. And if you just believe in that overall sub-industry, I can't get conviction beyond fairly equal diversification.
Well, even if you look in the fixed income markets too, those indexes, those funds are created by the company that takes out the most debt, gets the most weighting, and that really doesn't make sense intuitively. If it's really more, can they pay that debt back?
That's right, yeah. In that case, your portfolio managers are the collective wisdom of all the CFOs of the Fortune 500 companies in the U.S.
And you're allocated to the companies that have the most liability, which, I mean, debt is a liability, so it doesn't make sense. But you mentioned the trading costs, and when you look at the prevalence of market cap weighted passive indexes, at the point where market cap weighting really became a big thing, which is really back, started, I guess, in the mid-80s and then early 90s, really started to pick up steam, taking market share from price weighted, which, of course, is even worse. You know, makes no sense at all. But when the market cap weighted methodologies really started to become synonymous with index investing, at that point, the trading costs, which you mentioned, the trading costs were astronomically high compared to where they are today. And by weighting companies by the biggest, you're also, in a sense, weighting it by liquidity. It was a way to manage those trading costs. We're in an environment today where trading is literally free in many instances, free. We've talked a lot about free trading and commission-free trading, what happened and where that leads to and why. Just to take it back to market cap weighting, the fact that people can now trade for free on a portfolio management level, our trading costs are a de minimis amount of the portfolio, total costs. And for people like yourself who are buying stocks individually, those gates, those trading cost gates have come down. You don't have to pay $50 a ticket plus 1% on a share to have a runner go on the trading floor. And it's a completely different game now. Tell me, Andy, what are your thoughts on what happened to the whole trading commissions business?
Do you want to get into a brief history on that?
Yeah.
So you kind of referred to 40 years ago, it cost, I don't know, 50, I wasn't even alive then. It cost a lot of money to buy and sell stocks. I forget what exact year in the 70s when the whole kind of fixed brokerage commission went away, and it was the birth of the discount brokerages, Charles Schwab being the biggest example of that. And even then, it would still cost, I don't know, $45 to trade a stock in the 80s. And at that point, if even you have $1 million, you're 60-year-old, is thinking about retiring, and you've managed to save a lot of money in your life, and you just want efficient access, and you don't want to think about it too much, you're not trying to trade stuff, of course a mutual fund is a really efficient way to get access to the overall equity market and just let your wealth grow with keeping trading costs low. Over the course of the last 30 years, that went from something in the 40s down to the 20s and the 90s and 14.95, 12.95, 8.95, 4.95. And then recently, it's interesting, it was kind of the David kind of moving Goliath around on this one, because there was Robinhood trading for free, but you could only do it on your phone. And it was mostly young people. It was not our typical client, but certainly friends of mine playing with stocks on Robinhood totally trade for free. At least they think it trades for free. You know, they aren't paying attention to the bid-ask spreads usually. And then you have Interactive Brokers, this other relatively small player compared to Fidelity and Charles Schwab, who was trying to kind of preach. You could even see their commercials about, they wouldn't specifically call it Robinhood, but it seemed pretty clear, kind of given the animation going on screen, a guy with a green hat and a red feather in his cap kind of abusing clients with a free trading sign over the door. And Interactive Brokers would just say clearly, like, look, we're going to charge you a couple bucks for the trade. But in exchange for that, we do our best to get you BEX execution, and we guarantee we're not taking any kickbacks from whatever exchange orders get routed to. We work to keep the implicit cost as low as possible, and yes, we do charge an explicit cost. Thing is, that's super nerdy. I understand it. You guys understand it. But your typical 30, 40, 60-year-old person who was an engineer in their career and now they're trading stocks with some slice of their money for fun does not understand that argument whatsoever. So Interactive Brokers in September came out with, all right, fine, since we can't make this case kind of through our nerdy commercials, we'll try to make it a different way. We'll launch, I think they call it Interactive Brokers Lite. We don't work with Interactive Brokers, so I'm just seeing this from the outside. Interactive Brokers Lite, that is free trading, but we don't make any of those promises or guarantees about best execution and where orders get routed, and they probably do get paid something back by the exchanges so they can make some piece of revenue. But they still have Interactive Brokers Pro, cost something to trade, and you do get that best execution. So now Interactive Brokers is like, look, here are both models. Pick whichever one you like. We think you should probably be in Pro. That's what we've been saying for years. But we'll give them both to you so you can make a pure apples-to-apples comparison. And the very next month, I was a little bit surprised by this. I didn't think that Fidelity, Schwab, TD Ameritrades of the world really paid this much attention to what folks like Interactive Brokers and Robinhood are doing. But I think maybe they're worried about losing the next generation of their clients to the Robinhoods of the world. I think it was TD Ameritrade that started saying $0 for trading. And then it was just a stack of dominoes after that. We think this is great, or at least I think this is great. You know, there's interesting debate happening inside even our office about what this means for the world. Will E-Trade exist 10 years from now? I think that they're most exposed to the problem of this. Their revenues aren't as diversified. Certainly nobody wants a monopoly or even a duopoly in the custodian business. So you do want the ecosystem of these businesses to be successful over long periods of time so that they can be there to provide markets for us all. But in the meantime, don't tell me that my client's saving $5 every time we go in and out of stocks or ETFs is a bad thing. That's definitely good. And there's this kind of patronizing view that I hear some people say of, it was better when it cost more to trade because it kept people from shooting themselves in the foot. This just encourages more people to do more trading. That sounds to me like your grandpa saying, unlimited data plan is a bad thing because it means that your grandkids are using their phone at the table more often. Unlimited data plan is a good thing. If you don't want your kids using their phones at the table, then tell them to put it away. If I found out that one of our clients had their own kind of personal account over to the side, which some of them do, and they have enough money, they're allowed to do what they want. I mean, it's all their money to begin with. If they started telling me stories about, oh, well, now that it trades for free, I'm going in and out all the time, and it's a lot of fun, but I'm losing tons of money, I'd be like, right, you shouldn't let the lack of friction lead to more irrational trading. You do have to be thoughtful. So I think it is a danger, potentially, for the retail do-it-yourselfer who might feel like now they're going to get even more active, and there are all sorts of great studies that show the more you trade, especially when it really ramps up high, the worse you do. But I think clients of firms like ours that have always owned that fiduciary standpoint, and from our perspective, this just means trading costs are lower. The way that we trade isn't really going to change. The volume and velocity of our trading isn't going to change.
We do manage the capital markets for a lot of other asset managers that we partner with, and we've seen a very similar thing where when we have clients, when the clients of our clients, so when financial advisors or hedge funds or traders are going to place a large size order on a smaller ETF, that when they work with us, that they can get filled very favorably, and we can help maintain the market on both sides. It's very beneficial, and the idea that, oh, you can just trade and blast out market orders both ways and not pay any commissions is very much a misnomer. You might not be paying commissions, but you are paying, and increasingly now the power in that whole ecosystem is going towards the high-frequency traders and the intermediaries on a trade. They're not intermediaries at the software level where you're executing at the broker, but they're intermediaries in the market themselves because they have better technology and are faster. And the problem that I see is that it's a problem of transparency, whereas before you knew how your trade was being executed, and now your order flow is being sold and you don't know. That doesn't mean that is bad. In most cases, I don't think it is. But long term, I think the market would be better if they knew where their order goes, who makes money on it, how they make money on it, and ultimately, what are they getting, how is their trade being executed, and they know that it's being executed the right way.
Yeah, we've seen it trading. We were talking about this before the show, with the defined maturity bond ETF. By and large, people buy them and then hold them to maturity. So it's kind of a one-sided market where there's a folks of buyers like us, and then there's one or two sellers that are on the market-making side. And then there are the folks in the high-frequency space who are trying to make some money off of playing around in there, because you're talking about an ETF that tracks bond index and that costs money to build the shares and the bonds have bid-ask spreads. And so they aren't always trading at a penny. And that doesn't mean it's bad. It's fair for everybody in the chain of creating this really useful product gets compensated fairly for their work, and that's represented in the bid-ask spread. But we've certainly seen it on some light trading day. There's 100 shares or 200 shares available at a reasonable price. But if you just put in a trade for 500 of those at market, you'll get the first 100 or 200 at the price that you see. And then the rest, the trade moves away from you. So that's why we pay to use limit orders when needed. We pay attention to those markets. You kind of put your toe in and grab that 100 shares and then see what happens to the price. And if you need to walk away, walk away. And that's what I think kind of bring to the table if you're talking about a professional trading team.
When you talk about your international stocks, I know you put a lot of thought and work into hedging out the currency risk that's embedded with those stocks. One of my pet peeves in the market, if you look at the flows of currency hedged ETFs, ETFs that have foreign stocks and then they hedge out the currency exposure so you get pure play exposure to the stocks without the currency risk. When you look at the flows of some of those products, when the dollar is strong, you see flows into currency hedge products, as it should be, and people are hedging out that risk. And then all of a sudden the dollar is weak and the money's coming out. It's a pretty direct correlation. And it kind of illustrates the fact that people are using these funds not to hedge out currency exposure, but to try to add some alpha. That when the trade is working in their favor, all of a sudden they're not worried about the risk. When the trade is working against them, it's pretty ridiculous. And I think really the intention here, what the product providers and what the research in this space shows, is you want to hedge out. You don't want to double up that risk. And you certainly don't want to be trying to market time that risk or essentially embedding a currency bet into your equity portfolio. You're really just trying to mitigate that risk and take it away so that you can provide the equity exposure that you're looking for. How do you manage that currency risk?
Yeah. So I think that you got to just figure out what your intention is. Your goal is to have allocation to international equities that by and large are subject to the same economic forces as your domestic equities, but a little bit diversified. Certainly, you're talking about mostly global large cap companies. Microsoft is a global company that happens to be based in the US. Meanwhile, Airbus is a global company that happens to be based in Europe. But it does provide some diversification, and they do have greater exposure to these other markets. But it is an equity trade. If you wanted to make some trade inside of a currency and you wanted to play the euro versus the dollar or the yen versus the won or whatever, well, go do that. If you have an opinion about currency, then don't mess around with equities that have embedded currency inside of them. Don't have Airbus risk while you're trying to get your euro exposure. Just go buy the euro if you think the euro is going to go up versus the dollar. But when you buy a share of Airbus by itself, you are effectively saying, I think the dollar is going to do poorly, because you turn your dollars into euros, you go buy your share of Airbus, the price of the stock moves around, the euro versus the dollar moves around, and when you need to sell back, you sell your Airbus shares, you get euros, you convert it back to dollars. And if the dollar has strengthened over that time, you lost some money if the stock was flat. That's kind of what you're getting into, is that in these currency hedge products, it does seem like when the dollar is strong, and that is a losing trade on the currency side, people's international equity allocation tends towards the currency hedged. And then when it starts to reverse, they go off to the unhedged side and play the weak dollar all the way down. We are anti-market timers. We think it's a fool's errand. Certainly, sometimes you're lucky. We think that trying to predict that kind of stuff is hubris. So therefore, if you look at, and you can kind of show this academically, look at a dollar versus a basket of developed international currencies. And sometimes being short the dollar is great, and sometimes being short the dollar really hurts from a performance perspective. It always adds volatility. So if you take a purely passively currency hedged basket of international stocks versus an unhedged basket of international stocks, the volatility over long periods of time is higher, and the overall return over long periods of time is more or less the same depending on which exact rolling 3 or 5 year period you look at. And if you go into the entire exercise saying market timing is a thing that you shouldn't engage in, then you just buy the currency hedged access and stick with it through thick and thin. Sometimes it's going to help, sometimes it's going to hurt. I think it's especially hard for wealth management firms that are really index focused. If you're pointing to some well-known international index that's unhedged, and it's too easy to be tempted to kind of, in a strong dollar environment, to point to your performance versus the index and say, well, isn't that great? And then you've got to explain it on the other side when it goes against you. I think, again, your clients have to understand the story. We were talking about this earlier. If they don't understand what they're invested in, then it's very difficult for everybody to stay engaged in the process when even when it's kind of going against you. So we believe in doing that consistently over long periods of time. ETFs are the way to do that, though, because if you know you're talking about a million dollar rollover IRA that somebody's brought over, doing currency hedging inside of a portfolio like that, you're talking about bid-ask spreads, the currency markets will take a retail investor out to the woodshed. And it's hard to see from the client's perspective, but there's no reason to waste money there when you have these large institutional funds from a number of different providers that are available, that because they're dealing with hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars, can hedge the currency very efficiently, charge a reasonable fee in the underlying expense ratio, and we just allocate there.
Well, you know, there's one thing that I was just thinking about, Andy. Let's say Airbus. You're actually almost not quite double, but you're more than just one time exposed to the currency by owning the stock, because Airbus is located in Europe. So when they translate all their revenues from the global, whatever country they're doing business in, they're still translating it back into euros. That's being reflected in their revenue numbers, which in their cash flow, which eventually dictates stock price. So you're getting that exposure. And then you're getting the fact that you own the stock, which has a price in euros, and you're getting the currency exposure there.
Yep. Some CFOs of those companies hedge out their internal operating currency risk. Others don't. Trying to make equity allocation decisions around those things that often can be ephemeral. Again, we'll add that to the list of fool's errands. You work to invest in companies that have intelligent management teams that are managing their businesses well and paying attention to when, oh, we have some big project or expected sale that isn't finalized yet, but here we are investing in capital that's hopefully going to that sale. How much currency risk are we exposed to over the next 18 months when we get from start to finish? A good management team should be paying attention to that sort of stuff. They won't listen to me no matter what opinions I have on it, so don't even bother.
Andy, I'd like to close with this question, which is, tell me an obstacle that you've had either in your life or your career that you've either found a way to work around or persisted through.
If you don't mind, give you the kind of brief history of my background, because it's a weird one for folks in our industry. I'm an engineer by training and undergrad, moved out to Boston right after I got married out of college because my wife wanted to go to grad school out there, started looking for work in 2004, which wasn't exactly a recession, but we were kind of coming out of it. So difficult time to find work. Landed at a school running their technology department, and a few years later decided to get into investing. Started at Boston College in 2008 and graduated in 2009. Which is a wonderful time to learn about markets, and credit to BC's professors for kind of pivoting and taking that opportunity to really teach us some interesting things. A horrible time to start your career in investing in the summer of 2009. Ran my own business for a while, spent some time at another educational nonprofit, and then landed at John Hancock a couple years later in their mutual fund division, and then came home. But I'll never forget the networking that I was doing in that time in 2000. You know, even while I was in grad school, 2008, 2009, 10, 11, there are a couple of people that I really remember as being extremely generous with their time. There's a guy named, you might not even remember me, and he's not exactly in the investing world, but he came out of BC. His name is Matt Gagne. He's still out in Boston somewhere, I think. But I found him in the Boston College Alumni Network and sent him, just cold called him, sent him an email saying, I'd love to do some networking. Would you mind getting on the phone? He said, we're not getting on the phone. You're going to come downtown. I'll take you out to lunch. I love getting out of the office. You can tell me your story. I'll tell you mine. And if I know anybody who I can help you, I'd love to do it. He kind of was a catalyst for me on what it means to do high quality networking and what it means to be really generous with your time. That was a really difficult time to be looking for work. I managed to get through it, landed my career in a great place, and I learned all sorts of stuff along the way. If I went back and changed it, who knows if I'd even be where I am. So I would never say I want to go back and change it, but it was hard. And even though here we are in a historically great job market for lots of folks, there's still people who are struggling in their particular situation. Maybe they're in a job they don't want or trying to make a career shift like I did. And I really believe that the power of the network is real. And it's the responsibility of all of those of us who have kind of made it to where we want to be to open up ourselves to those people who are looking for help. And if somebody calls you and asks for help, you gotta say yes and be excited about saying yes and just help people network. You know, it's not a job interview, it's just networking. There are like two or three people in my life who have really made all the difference because they were just generous with their time and their network.
Well, a couple of years ago, there was a startup ETF issuer that landed in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And I could tell you, Andy, that you were one of the most open people that we met with and easiest to engage. And you were very helpful for us when we were starting out in Ann Arbor and didn't know anybody back then. So I want to thank you for that. You truly do walk the walk.
Thanks. I try. It takes a lot of time, but it's fun. You get to help people out.
And you know what? It ties into something that my mentor told me, but I always think about, is the best investment you can make is in people. And the gentleman you had spoke of, and you yourself with us taking time when we were first in Ann Arbor, it's an investment of your time, but it pays dividends for down the stream.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think it's a beautiful place to leave it off. I want to thank you, Andy, for coming in, for your time. Thank you, the listener, for your time and attention today. Please like, rate, share, review, anything else with the podcast if you are so inclined. And until next week, have a great week of trading and investing.
Thanks for joining us this week on the ETF Experience Podcast. Be sure to visit us at exponentialetfs.com to join the conversation and view our show notes. If you love this episode of the ETF Experience, head over to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and to leave a review. As always, thanks for listening and see you next week.
This Exponential Exceptional podcast is published and provided for informational and entertainment purposes only. All opinions expressed by the show participants are solely their current opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Exponential ETFs. None of the information constitutes a recommendation that any particular security, portfolio of securities, transaction, or investment strategy is suitable for any specific person.